From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, vanished civilizations. Here's what's happening. President Donald Trump has announced that the White House's plans for rolling back social distancing measures and reopening the country's economy in several phases, depending on location amid the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the plan calls for three phases to reopening the country based on the severity of the coronavirus outbreak in each individual state or region. Now, the plan, which the president announced along with the formation of a bipartisan council of lawmakers from both chambers of Congress, outlines recommendations for governors to develop their own plans to reopen. It also includes a number of criteria that must be met in terms of numbers of infections and hospitalizations before they can open up. In a moment, we'll be talking with a former New York Times reporter who's got his thoughts on the coronavirus outbreak. Now, the governors of Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, and Indiana, and Kentucky have announced that they will all work in close coordination to reopen the Midwest regional economy in the wake of this pandemic. Now, as we've been reporting and as we reported first in December, there is now increasing confidence that the COVID-19 outbreak likely originated in a Wuhan laboratory, though not as a bioweapon, but as part of a China's attempt to demonstrate that its efforts to identify and combat viruses are equal to or greater than the capabilities of the United States, according to multiple sources who have been briefed on the details of the early actions by China's government and seen relevant materials. How about that story? And of course, as we've been reporting, both the United States and Canada have sent money to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the Chinese lab that multiple sources tell some media that they are suspected of being the likely source of the coronavirus pandemic, with the Canadian funding coming as recently as last month, by the way. A record 22 million Americans have sought unemployment benefits over the past month, with millions more filing claims last week, almost wiping out all of the job gains since the Great Recession and underscoring the toll on the economy from extraordinary measures to control this outbreak. Let's check in with our representative, Charles Koppus, on this. Chuck, this situation here, I don't know. I think it's going to get better. What's your take?
Well, it's... Like you said, there's 22 million people. This is unprecedented. In just 4 weeks, we've wiped out all the gains since 2009. That's almost 20% unemployment, like 1929. I would say for perspective, in 2008, the highest unemployment was 650,000. So this is way beyond anything we've ever seen. And the CARES Act even now extends the unemployment benefits to another 23 million people who are self-employed, the gig economy. As I learned, you know, researching this today, this would be almost 40 million people or more, almost the same amount who have no savings. So it doesn't look very good, George, because, you know, 70% of this economy is consumer spending, and people are just not, well, they're just not spending. That's the velocity of money. And then the small businesses, about 60% of our economy, and the SBA just today, I think yesterday, ran out of $350 billion, just like that.
Yeah, gone, so, which was some of the money that was supposed to go to small businesses.
Yeah, and retail sales are down 8.7%. It was 3.7% in 2008. So everything we're seeing right now, it's really pointing more towards a depression, not just a recession. And the Fed has basically nationalized our U.S. industry and capital markets. This is encouraging moral hazard. And George, I just hope and pray we can get through this.
Well, and if we opened up tomorrow, Chuck, which we won't, but if we did, how long would it take the economy to spur back?
I don't know. They say 50% of these small businesses right now are not even going to come back at all. 47,000 stores have closed.
Oh, my God.
JCPenney has just filed for bankruptcy. You know, this is looking like the financial reckoning day that I warned about in my book, you know, 10 years ago, and hopefully we can discuss that someday before it's too late, but...
Absolutely, Chuck. Thank you. Chuck's book, by the way, is called America's Financial Reckoning Day. His website, Chuck Koppus, COPPES.com, linked up at our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. More than 50 cell towers in the United Kingdom were vandalized over the weekend with major telecom companies blaming the fraudulent conspiracy theory, they say, that 5G connectivity is the cause of the coronavirus. We're going to do a show about 5G on that. It's hard enough to fall asleep when times are normal, but add an extra viral pandemic to the mix, and millions of Americans are finding themselves up all night due to worry, anxiety, and fear of the future. A recent piece of research surveyed 1,000 Americans on their sleep habits in the wake of the coronavirus situation, and almost 80% of them admitted that their sleep has indeed been affected, as yours. 4 in 10 Americans are lonelier now than ever before as a result of the pandemic, according to new research. Another survey of 1,000 Americans asked respondents to think about how the outbreak is affecting them and revealed it's caused loneliness to hit new heights for 44% of those surveyed. Dr. Peter Breggin with us. And Peter, before we react to this story of loneliness, you've got a video and blog on your website, Breggin.com, that talks about the situation that we funded that Wuhan lab. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yes, George, we did something that was even more horrendous than that. In 2015, there's a scientific paper in Nature Medicine that describes how the U.S. government and the Chinese government together funded research with Americans and with Wuhan Institute researchers, that wretched place. And together, the Americans and the Wuhan researchers created a novel coronavirus. They did this, George, several years now. It was 2015, a number of years ago. They studied the virus. They created it from the same bat creature that the COVID-19 came from. They found that it was highly infectious. They found that it was really very, very dangerous. And the NIH, after looking at how dangerous it was, decided, probably because of, our crazy views on China at the time, that there was still a good thing. Go ahead with it. So a lot of whatever's going on in Wuhan right now has to do with not just the funding, but the fact that we helped train their scientists basically biological weapons.
As we've been reporting, and this story about loneliness, this is obvious, isn't it?
Yeah, loneliness is one of the hardest things in the whole world, George. And as obvious it is, most of us, including me, much of my life, we don't want to admit that we're lonely. We feel shy about it. So I'm gonna out myself, George, and say that I was lonely specifically from age 5 to age 48.
Well, you're not lonely anymore, Doc. Dr. Peter Breggin, thank you so much for what you've been doing for us during this situation, by the way. One of my favorite actors, veteran actor Brian Dennehy, known for roles in Rambo, First Blood, Tommy Boy, and To Catch a Killer, has died at the age of 81 years old. You might not know his name, but when you see him, you surely recognize him. Well, up next, the former New York Times reporter Alex Berenson joins me to talk about his thoughts of the coronavirus. And wait till you hear what Alex has to say next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce our guest to you. Alex Berenson graduated from Yale University back in 1994 with degrees in history and economics. He then joined the Denver Post as a reporter in 1996. He became one of the first employees at TheStreet.com, which was a groundbreaking financial news website back in 1999. He then joined the New York Times at the Times, covered everything from the drug industry to Hurricane Katrina, and he served 2 stints as a correspondent in Iraq. He left the Times in 2010 to devote himself to writing fiction, but conversations with his wife led him to begin researching the science around cannabis and mental illness, a project that became the book Tell Your Children, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. Time permitting tonight with Alex, we'll talk about that book as well. He has been all over the country in different stories, being quoted as the ex-New York Times reporter, warning of a big pivot from officials to justify lockdown strategy. And I thought, let's bring him on. Alex, first of all, I want to thank you for the guts for coming forward to talk about this, because it echoes a lot of things that we believe here on this program. So welcome to Coast, Alex.
It's a pleasure to be on.
This coronavirus story is unbelievable. It's I've said from the get-go that I believed it was concocted in a lab, that the media was creating a hysteria. What's your take on this now, Alex, as a insider looking in, basically?
Well, I'm actually not an insider at all. I'm really an outsider. And really what all I'm trying to do is look at some of the data that's come out around the coronavirus and who's really most likely to be affected by it, which is very clearly elderly people and people with underlying conditions, and questions about, the modeling that showed there would be huge death counts and what that, whether that modeling has been accurate, which it clearly has not been. And, now I think there are questions about the death tolls and how aggressively, I would say, the United States and New York City and New York State are counting deaths. It's not a secret that they're doing this. It's public that they're doing this in a fairly aggressive way. And, and questions about the efficacy of the lockdowns and lockdowns versus social distancing versus masks. I'm to be honest with you, I'm not particularly interested in where the coronavirus came from, whether I doubt it was biologically engineered or anything like that. In general, my explanations for human events and human decision making tend to run towards incompetence and political pressure and people talking themselves into positions that they have a hard time talking themselves out of. I don't really believe in grand conspiracies, so I may be different than you or mm-hmm. some of your listeners in that way. That doesn't mean we don't have a problem right now. We have a problem. We have lockdowns that are very, very economically destructive and societally destructive and constitutionally destructive. And we basically did those in a matter of days in mid-March. And I understand why we did them. There was a lot of fear at the time, and we hadn't really prepared for this thing. In February we could have, and we absolutely hit the panic button, and the media encouraged that. But now that we have a lot more data about the coronavirus, and it doesn't seem to be quite as scary or as dangerous to the general population as we thought, I think it's time and past time to consider what we're going to do next. So that's my focus, and I'm not some insider, and I don't have people whispering to me from the CIA about, okay. What they really know, about the coronavirus in Wuhan. That's not a game I'm going to play. So I just want to be clear about that.
As somebody who's been in the media for a number of years, when we look at what was happening as this first started breaking, I've never seen media handle a story like this, where they were giving us, and they still do now, daily counts of deaths and infections, when they never did this with the seasonal flu, where upwards of 60,000 Americans die every year. They never reported on that. Nowhere ever did I see stories about 20 people have died from the flu tonight. But with this, every day there was a count, and I think they scared the living daylights out of people.
No, and that's clearly true. That part is clearly true. First of all, just to say, it's not true that every year 60,000 Americans die from the flu. There have been
up to.
But yes, but the flu comes and goes every year. And with the exception in the last 20 years of the H1N1 swine flu in 2009, nobody pays any attention to it. It comes and they tell you to get a vaccine, and some people do and some people don't. And then a few people die from it, and that's the end of it. I totally agree. And we don't count the deaths this way, and we don't shut down the country this way. And, we have treated this entirely differently. And partly, you can clearly see several reasons why. One is, it came out of China and it was scary.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's not the flu. Physically, obviously, it's different than the flu. It's a different virus. It's a different viral vector than the flu. And, SARS, the original SARS and MERS are very lethal. So this has something in common with those. So people were scared. Okay, that's one reason. A second reason is that, when it came to the United States, where did it really hit hard, or where has it really hit hard? Well, New York City. So what do we know about New York City? New York City is the media capital of the world. So anything that happens in New York City gets magnified and blown, out of proportion. And by the way, this is an important thing. So things that are important get really blown out of proportion. And what else do we know? Well, I mean, people in the media hate Donald Trump. I mean, a lot of them, not all of them.
A lot of them do. Yep.
And let's be honest. And this, so if you lived in Brooklyn, or if you live in Brooklyn, and you, you grew afraid in mid-March or late March that this might actually kill you or kill someone you knew, and at the same time you hate Donald Trump and you personally blame Donald Trump for this, well, there was a hysteria that picked up that you can see in both the articles and the, you know, in the CNN coverage and the tweets, and it was off the charts, and it has not gone away. And look, I understand why people are scared, but what has happened now is people in the media, I mean, are actively misleading Americans about what the risks are here. So if you look at the risks, okay, one of the most unbelievable statistics in this is how age stratified the deaths are. And the best estimate is that more people over the age of 100 have died worldwide from this than under the age of 30. This just does not affect it. I mean, children can get it, but they don't get sick from it. They don't die from it. Same with teenagers and people in their 20s also. I mean, there's going to be some rare exceptions to this stuff. Just the way, a plane crashes once in a while, it does not mean that flying is not safe. This is incredibly age stratified. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do a lot about it. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try to protect people. But the strategy of shutting down the country to protect people who are in nursing homes is a crazy strategy. But if you're going to be honest, you have to be honest about who's getting sick and dying.
And what about the governors who seem to me, in my opinion, they are petrified of their own personal political career. So they all jumped on the same bandwagon going, I got to do something too. I mean, if the governor in Massachusetts shut down his state, I've got to shut down mine. And I think it began to mushroom like that and snowball.
It did, but I'd actually go the other way. It's not that they're petrified. The people, because the media has said this, are in favor of this. Most of the country, at least maybe in the last week, it has started to change a little bit. But in March, in late March, in early April, there was nothing you couldn't do that people wouldn't have supported. And so the governor, and by the way, like the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, when he said, I think we're going to need 140,000 beds and, we're going to need 40,000 ventilators, those numbers came from a real projection. Mm-hmm. He wasn't just making that up. So the terror that, I'm not going to say he was terrified, but the terror that you could see going through, state officials was real. Okay, so that happened, and there was political gain for some of these folks.
Sure, and they didn't want to be accused of doing nothing.
So now where are we? We're at a dangerous spot because anybody who looks at the numbers with any sort of reasonable eye right now can see that the threat is not what we thought it was. Instead of needing 140,000 beds, New York State at most is going to need 18,000 beds, and that number is going down. Instead of needing 40,000 ventilators, New York State probably peaked at about 4,000 ventilators. So the projections were off by 90%. But the problem is the lockdowns have actually been even worse than we expected a month ago in terms of their economic hit, in terms of their societal hit, arguably in terms of their, constitutional hit. And so the cure has proven to be really terrible, and the disease has proven to be not as terrible as we thought. So if you're a politician, how do you walk away and how do you back off without blowing up your political career? And I think that's where these guys are now.
Absolutely. And some of the mainstream media anchor people on these cable news channels, they're still getting paid. So, of course, they don't care what's going on. And so they jump on the bandwagon of shut the country down, let's protect everybody. But they're still getting their checks, Alex.
Very, very big checks. Very, very big checks.
Absolutely. What a situation. My gosh, it's frustrating for a lot of people. And the death count, they've got up to about 30,000 now that they claim have died from the coronavirus. Do you think that includes some of the seasonal flu?
Well, it's even more complicated than that. And actually tonight, because I'm trying to get, sort of look at the New York City numbers. So New York City has reported about 12,000 people in the last month have died from coronavirus. That's 7,500, quote unquote, confirmed. another 4,000 probable where they actually don't even have a positive test result. Here's what's confusing. Only, so that's 11,000.
Hold that thought right there, Alex. We're going to hit a break and come back. We'll pick it up right there at that spot because that's very important. And then later on this hour, let's talk a little bit about your book, Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. We'll be back in a moment with Alex Berenson as we get his take on the coronavirus and his book, Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. So we'll talk to him about that as well. Next hour, we're going live to South Africa. Michael Tellinger joins us for 3 hours to talk to us about vanished civilizations. It's an amazing story. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our final segment with Alex Berenson as we talk about the coronavirus. Alex, we were talking about death statistics and you were getting into New York. Let's get back into that.
Sure. So just very quickly, so the city has reported 7,500 confirmed deaths. That means there was a lab test showing the presence of coronavirus in someone who died. And another 4,000, quote unquote, probable deaths where essentially the person had a cough or had a fever or some other symptom that could have been coronavirus related and died. The problem is that the city has also said that that since this began, which was essentially mid-March, I think March 11th was the first coronavirus death, there have been about 3,000 deaths more than you would have expected in New York City, right? In New York City, every day people die, right?
Exactly.
So the city has a large population and it has a lot of elderly people. So depending on the season of the year, there could be 200 deaths a day. There's going to be fewer in the summer. There'll be a few more in the winter. There might be, seasonally, some winters are worse than others. There might be 250 deaths a day. It just varies, right, the day to day, year to year. In any case, the city health commissioner said that the city had seen 3,000 additional deaths, but there have been 11,500 deaths attributed to coronavirus. So it's pretty hard to look at that and not realize that some of these people must have died, quote, with rather than of the coronavirus. In other words, they were extremely elderly and they had underlying conditions. And, they became infected because the infection spread very rapidly in the city in the last month, and they died. And they would have died anyway. And then there's going to be another group of people who are quite sick, who the coronavirus probably pushed over the edge, right? So I have, the classic example, I have, congestive heart failure, I have end-stage renal disease, I have, I'm on dialysis, I'm very sick. And I'm going to die. I'm going to die this year at some point, but who knows when. And then I get the coronavirus, and it does lead me to die, more quickly than mm-hmm. I would have otherwise. So most of the people who are dying, of coronavirus are quite, they're quite old and they're quite sick. And I think there's a legitimate argument around whether those deaths should be classified as coronavirus deaths or as deaths from the underlying condition. And people have this argument about the flu too. There was actually a very good article from Canada, from the CBC in 2012 about flu death estimates raising this very point. So this is not a new debate. This debate of when people are quite sick and, a virus pushes them over the edge, what the correct classification is. It's very clear that for coronavirus, we're gonna classify as many deaths as possible as coronavirus deaths, as coronavirus related. And that's fine. Like that as long as it's disclosed, that's an okay way to do it. But people should be aware of what's going on, and they should be aware that the all-cause mortality numbers in New York don't quite line up with the top line coronavirus numbers.
And what about the hysteria, Alex? I was in a supermarket a couple days ago, and I don't wear the mask. I just don't. And a lot of people do. And if they want to, that's their prerogative. There's a lady coming down the aisle with her cart wearing a mask, and I'm walking down the aisle with a little basket without a mask. You would think the Grim Reaper was approaching her. She turned around and, ran with her cart to get away from me because I didn't have a mask on.
So people are terrified of this, and they have no idea what the risks actually are. This is the stuff that I want to focus on. They have no idea what the risks actually are to them, and they have no idea what the transmission vectors actually are. Okay, it is incredibly clear now. We have data from Germany and China, and you know, we have months of epidemiology on this. Most transmission of this virus occurs in really three ways. One, in the home. Okay, this is not measles. It's not, you know, it's not like if I sneeze from across the room, you're going to get this. There has to be some generally prolonged contact.
Right.
Not days, but there's got to be some prolonged contact. So the first way is in the home. And by the way, this is an argument that you know, sort of goes against lockdowns, because if a lot of transmission is happening in the home,
you're stuck in there.
That's right, and you may actually make things worse rather than better in the short run. Okay. The second primary mode of transmission appears to be public transportation, which is another reason why New York City has gotten hit so badly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're on a subway and you're on the subway for an hour with somebody who has this, you know, there's a good chance that it's going to jump around to other people in that subway car. Okay, and the third primary way is what's called nosocomially, which is essentially in hospitals and nursing homes. It's
right.
In medical settings. And again, that makes sense because you know, these are the doctors and the nurses and the staff can be a vector of transmission, or nursing homes that may not be that, unfortunately, that clean, that can be a vector of transmission. So those are the three main ways. There's a Chinese paper that came out about a week ago where a bunch of Chinese researchers looked at, no joke, thousands of cases, 7,000 infections, and they found that two of the 7,000 had occurred through outdoor transmission. And when they looked at clusters, they looked at, yeah, I know, it's incredible. They looked at 300 clusters totaling about 1,200 people. None of those clusters were outdoor. Most of them were in the home. Most of the rest were in public transportation. And even if you looked at stores and offices and restaurants, it was relatively low. This spreads in the home, and it spreads on public transportation. And so what we've done, I mean, you can argue a little bit about restaurants and bars and stores, but what we've done by denying people the chance to be outside and denying people the chance to, you know, children the chance to play, is just insane. It's insane. And it's doubly insane because kids are not at risk. It really upsets me.
And I wonder how many of us have the flu virus in us, but our immune system has kept it where it doesn't even fester. Is that conceivable?
I that's the kind of thing I don't know. Okay, and so that's the kind of stuff I try not to guess at, because what I'm more interested in is the coronavirus, right? And you know, look, again, it's quite clear the flu. You know, tens of millions of Americans get it every year. In Italy, by the way, you know, which has been quite badly hit by the coronavirus, Italy actually tends to get very badly hit by the flu on an annual basis. And in 2016, 2017, the best estimates are that 25,000 people at a minimum died of influenza. And if you look at what they call influenza-like illnesses in Italy, 45,000 died, which would be the equivalent of about 250,000 people in the U.S. And is about where the coronavirus numbers are likely to come in for Italy. So that's a bad number, okay? But we didn't blow up the world economy when that happened.
I want to spend some time talking about your book, Tell Your Children, in the last 10 minutes we've got remaining here, Alex. But before we get into that, what would be your best wish with this coronavirus situation in this country right now?
That people would understand who's really at risk, and that they would stop hiding their children away, and ideally that we'd open the schools pretty soon. Because one of the other terrible things about this is, you know, this puts a lot of stress on families, right?
Disruption, yeah.
And just physically, the fact that people are on top of each other all the time, and children are being hurt. In some cases, you know, I don't want to exaggerate it, but there is some evidence that child abuse is rising, and even that, you know, fatal child abuse is rising.
Suicides are going up.
Texas has been talking about this. Suicide, domestic violence, child abuse, it's all going the wrong way. So the number one thing I would say to people is understand your risk, and if you have children, your child's risk. Please understand that, and let your kids get some air and play with their friends. If you don't want them to play inside with their friends, okay. I mean, it's kind of crazy, but okay. But let people have play dates outside. You're just hurting your children.
What about the 18-year-olds who are going to graduate from high school, and they may not get that diploma because schools have been closed?
They've been denied.
And they were going to go to college in September. Yeah. What happened?
Listen, if this is still going on in September, there will be riots in the streets. Okay,
no question. Look what happened in Michigan just yesterday, you know.
That's right. It's been a matter of weeks. And especially if people start to understand what the numbers really are.
All right, tell your children the truth about marijuana, mental illness, and violence. How did this come about?
So you know, this is actually, in many ways, it's very interesting. Because to tell your children, my wife is a psychiatrist. She's a forensic psychiatrist. So she deals with the criminally mentally ill.
Oh, my God.
And over a period of years, she was telling me, you know, this person was high as a kite when they had, you know, committed this terrible crime. And, this person, you know, descended into schizophrenia and, you know, or severe bipolar disorder after years of smoking cannabis. And I honestly didn't believe her because, like most, you know, people who went to Yale and worked for the New York Times, I, quote unquote, knew that marijuana was safe, even though I didn't really, you know, use it. And, you know, and the handful of times in my life when I had used it, I didn't particularly like it, but whatever, I didn't care. So she eventually convinced me to start looking at what the medical data actually said, the data published in really good peer-reviewed journals like The Lancet or the British Medical Journal or the Journal of the American Medical Association, and the data is unequivocal. Cannabis is a real risk factor for severe mental illness, especially schizophrenia, and it unquestionably causes short-term psychotic episodes, frequently. This is frequent enough that users will joke about it, right?
If you get really
high and you wind up in your closet for the night because you're afraid your friends, you know, are gonna steal all your money or whatever it is, you've had a minor psychotic episode. You know, that's not the kind that lands you in the emergency room, but a step beyond that will land you in the emergency room.
That's right, and you could do something to yourself.
That's right, or to somebody else.
So
here's the thing. So I wrote this book. It came out last January. It's, you know, Tell Your Children, and I was a reporter for the Times for 10 years. And the book is, in terms of its analysis of the data, it's airtight. Okay, I've presented it to, you know, psychiatry groups in, you know, on multiple continents. It's all peer-reviewed research. There's a little bit of original research in there, and I'm happy if people want to say, look, this risk may be real, but we should still legalize cannabis. You know, alcohol is legal. Alcohol kills lots of people. Cannabis, so what if there's some risk? It should be legal, and nobody should be arrested for it. Okay, that's a totally plausible argument, but that's not how the book was received. Okay, the book was attacked by pro-cannabis advocates who said basically, the science is wrong and Berenson is cherry-picking and, you know, I'm misreading the data. And none of that stuff was true. And in places like the Times, at the Washington Post, and a lot of cable outlets essentially refused to cover the book. And so when this happened with the coronavirus in the last month, this is something I'm very used to now. I understand how media groupthink works because yeah, these people just refuse to engage in a meaningful way with a book that a lot of psychiatrists have endorsed and know is correct. And
you know,
we most likely
would have done a show with you just on your book, by the way, just so you know.
You know, and maybe, listen, we could do that some other time if you've got a spare hour, right? But because it's a really, you know, people should know about this. But the stakes on coronavirus are 100 times as high, right? We're literally putting our economy into depression on the basis of unfortunately, a lot of media hysteria that as more data rolls in, is not being updated. And the media is so busy yelling at itself that it won't engage with what the science really says. And that is very bad news.
It really is. Well, you've done a remarkable job there. How do people get that book, Tell Your Children?
Tell Your Children is available on Amazon. And, you know, it's funny, people seem to want to buy the hardcover. The paperback actually has sort of an afterword that I where I go into some of the the media response to the book, which for people who are interested in that topic is directly relevant.
Alex's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Alex, why do you think the media, back to coronavirus for a moment, why do you think the media seems to be creating this hysteria? I mean, I've never seen them hype something like they've hyped this.
Again, I think people in New York were quite scared for a while, and that was real. And I do think, unfortunately, that everything is seen through the prism of Trump. And by the way, that definitely hurt Tell Your Children too. That somehow Trump was viewed as anti-cannabis, even though there's not much evidence that he cares either way about cannabis. And so when the fact that that Trump is the president and the response in February was inadequate led people to to fight with him, literally to fight with him. People like Jim Acosta at CNN, yep. or Maggie Haberman at the Times, people will just attack him, and he is smart in that he knows that's actually good for his brand, I think, and so he baits them, and it becomes about him rather than about the reality of the data.
How is your former newspaper, the New York Times, handling this coronavirus story, in your opinion?
They're handling it quite badly. There's been a lot of problems in New York. They could have written, and they have written, a lot of stories about those problems and still said what's happening in New York is not entirely representative of what we're seeing in the rest of the country. In the rest of the country, hospitals are not filling up with coronavirus patients. In the rest of the country, in fact, hospitals are furloughing workers, and a couple of hospitals have closed, and that's an astonishing fact, right? We're in the middle of what is supposed to be the worst pandemic since the Spanish flu, and we have hospitals closing and nurses being laid off and doctors closing their practices because they don't have patients right now. And so the Times should have presented a much more accurate overall picture and could have done that while still talking about the problems of the virus.
Yeah, and that's happening all around the country. But when we start going back to work, do you think that's going to change and flip around again?
I hope that over time, people who aren't too completely terrified to leave their houses will see, I don't actually know anybody who died from this except maybe, my 80-year-old, grandmother's friend or something like that. And I know people who got it and recovered from it. And I hope people will see, okay, yes, this was bad for some people, but overall it didn't wreck society, and we really have to get back to work. And again, more than anything else, I hope people will see my kids are fine.
And I think they better get used to it coming back every season. I don't think this is going to go away.
No, that's true. Maybe this, or maybe some cousin of it, right? But okay, we don't shut society down for the flu, and we can't shut society down for this. Not based on what the death numbers are. If this were killing 5 or 10 or God forbid 20% of people, I mean we'd really have to basically rework our society. For a virus that seems to at worst kill maybe 1 in 300 people who get it, and nearly all those people are extremely old and sick, or maybe it's 1 in 200, but it's not a number that should destroy our society, especially considering who's really being hurt by this. We're going to have to live with it. It's not going to be fun, but we live with things. We live with HIV. We live with tuberculosis. We live with 40,000 automobile deaths a year. We can't shut society.
Exactly. Alex, thank you so much. Keep in touch with our staff. We'll get you back again. Love to use you as a source for other stories, too. You've got your head on your shoulders. Up next, live, South Africa, Michael Tellinger, Vanished Civilizations.